1980 Sierra State versus Jennings. Mr. Weber.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. This is an interlocutory appeal from a Rock County Circuit Court order granting Edward Jennings' motion to suppress statements made to a Beloit police detective. The appeal presents two substantive questions and, or rather two procedural questions, excuse me, and one substantive question of law. The first procedural question is what should the Court of Appeals do when it is presented with a federal question and two conflicting decisions on point, one decision of this court and a later decision of the United States Supreme Court. The state takes the position that under those circumstances, the Court of Appeals should certify the case to this court under authority of Rule 809.61. The second procedural question is, what should the Court of Appeals do if this court refuses the certification? The state has taken the position that the Court of Appeals should follow the United States Supreme Court's precedent under those circumstances.
Counsel, is your position the Court of Appeals should certify or the Court of Appeals must certify, that it be a mandatory rule of court administration?
I think both the public defender and the Attorney General have argued that this court, under its superintending authority, should direct the Court of Appeals to certify under those circumstances.
How do you answer?
Go ahead, David.
Mr. President. Determine that it's a federal question.
A matter of federal constitutional law, interpretation of a provision of the Constitution. I think if it's not a federal question, this court's authority to speak on an issue of state law would be preeminent. I would define a federal question the way the U.S. Supreme Court does, a matter of federal constitutional law, interpretation of the federal document.
In your default, you suggest that now I have clarification. Should means mandatory, and both of you are on board with regard to mandatory, as I read the opposing counsel. You have a default rule. The default apparently is if the court doesn't take it, then the U.S. Supreme Court decision should prevail. I'm certainly mindful of the supremacy clause, but what do we do about our state constitution with that default rule?
This court's pronouncements on state constitutional law would still be predominant, would still trump either a decision. I can't imagine the U.S. Supreme Court making a pronouncement of state constitutional law, but if this court was in conflict with the Court of Appeals.
Let me be more clear in my question, and that is, does the Court of Appeals then have any room to interpret the case under our state constitution? If the Supreme Court of the United States says it one way and our court has said it not involving and invoking the state constitution a different way.
Sure. The shibboleth is that the Court of Appeals is an error-correcting court and this court is a law-making court.
Yes.
The reality is that the Court of Appeals makes law all the time. If this court has not spoken on a matter of state constitutional law, the Court of Appeals, I believe, has a choice to make. They can address it as an issue of first impression. Some districts are more quick to do that than others. Or they could certify the case to this court for determination of the state constitutional issue. I don't think this case reaches that fact circumstance, but it seems to me as a matter of practice, the Court of Appeals could either keep the state Supreme Court question for itself or certify. Am I answering your question?
Yes.
Badly?
I'm still thinking about it. Thank you, though.
Counsel, let me ask you whether or not you think there's any waste of judicial resources in the suggestion that's been made. If we say to the Court of Appeals in every instance, you have to certify this to our court, and then we'll decide whether or not to take the certification. Isn't that somewhat a waste of judicial resources? Why shouldn't we take the position that the Court of Appeals is capable of looking at the state decision looking at the apparently more recent U.S. Supreme Court decision and applying what appears appropriate.
Justice Crooks, that's the position that the state took in the Court of Appeals in this case. We argued, and I think I cited Esser, State versus Esser, in the Court of Appeals that basically said, if it is so clear that a subsequent U.S. Supreme Court decision has overruled state Supreme Court precedent, the Court of Appeals is free to follow that U.S. Supreme Court precedent. The Court of Appeals kind of caught us by surprise with the certification in this case, although they noted the line of authority from Whitaker that says basically that this court is the law-creating court. The Court of Appeals is an error-correcting court, and there is, in fact, a portion of a decision, and it may be Cook. It may be from In re Cook v. Cook that says that this court basically has the authority to overrule itself.
Yeah, my sense is that it's, and correct me if I'm wrong, the Cook case that said this court is the only court that has the power to withdraw, change, modify, or overrule one of its court, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin's decisions.
And I guess I'm curious as to why you changed your position from the position you took in the Court of Appeals to the position you're now taking here. Why do you think that what you're now proposing is the better rule?
Mostly because I didn't have a real opportunity, didn't take the opportunity, to look at that language in Cook v. Cook about this court reserving its own authority to consider or reconsider its own precedent. I would be perfectly happy with this court saying the Supremacy Clause exists. If the U.S. Supreme Court has spoken on a question that we had spoken to earlier and reached a different conclusion, the U.S. Supreme Court is the final arbiter of federal constitutional issues. The lower court, the intermediate appellate court, should consider itself bound by U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Now that begs the question in certain cases, if there really is a conflict between decisions, between a decision of the state Supreme Court and a later decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, in this case, I don't think there's much question that Davis overruled Wentella, and this court in Harris a couple of years ago said really that Wentella doesn't provide a whole lot of guidance anymore. But playing it safe, as is my wont, I assumed that this court would want to retain the authority to say that we have, in essence, been overruled, or to say that there really is a conflict between the state Supreme Court decision and the federal decision.
My understanding, the Court of Appeals has gone both ways on this issue.
It has.
Sometimes it says, hey, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has been overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court. We follow the U.S. Supreme Court. And other times it says, this is a decision for the state Supreme Court to make.
The court and District 4 apparently felt strongly enough about this to certify the issue. And frankly, after looking at the certification and looking at their concerns and then doing a little more digging, I see that they have a legitimate concern. There are two lines of authority.
Well, it may be a legitimate concern, and it may be a great import to the Court of Appeals and maybe this court, maybe to the two of you as counsel, but I do not think Mr. Jennings is very interested in it.
Probably.
I think Mr. Jennings is interested in whether his statement has to be suppressed, right? So, unless there are further questions on that.
And that leads us to the third question. Was Jennings's comment, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer, an unequivocal request for counsel? The state has taken the position that no, Jennings's statement was not an unequivocal request for counsel. That statement reflected indecision and uncertainty as to whether he wanted a lawyer. And as such, it was not sufficient to halt further questioning under Davis versus United States and Edwards versus Arizona. So at bottom, on the substantive legal issue, we're asking you to reverse the circuit court suppression order and remand the case for further proceedings. The standard in Davis is simple and straightforward. If a reasonable police officer would understand only that a suspect might be invoking his right to counsel, he does not have to stop questioning. He does not have to stop questioning. In this case, as we argued on brief, Detective Kreitzman proceeded with a superabundance of caution. He was not obliged to stop questioning under the facts and circumstances of this case when considered in light of Davis. And the statements that were subsequently made to Detective Anderson some 15 minutes after the first questioning ended should have been deemed admissible by the Supreme Court. Now, Mr. Jennings has raised a question of the standard of review that this court should be employing here, and I'd like to address that briefly. It's my understanding that Jennings believes that the circuit court's conclusion that Mr. Jennings requested counsel is a finding of fact that is entitled to deference on appeal, and we strongly disagree with that. This court has consistently drawn a distinction between findings of historical fact, who said what, when did they say it, credibility questions. All of those are findings of fact. They're entitled to deference on appeal. But whether facts satisfy a constitutional standard is a question of law, reserved to the appellate courts to ensure continuity between cases. The fact that Mr. Jennings said, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer, is a finding of fact. It's a finding of historical fact. The man said this at a particular point in time. The legal import of that finding, whether or not it was an unequivocal assertion of the right to counsel, that's a question of law. That's a question of law, reviewed de novo, and reviewed by this court in accordance with existing precedent. And as we say, the precedent in this case is Davis versus United States.
Does the language of the Davis case, is it fully consistent with the facts of the Davis case?
At least you thought so before the question, right?
I'm sorry?
At least you thought so before the question, right?
Exactly. Did you perceive inconsistency?
Well, wasn't there an explicit clarification or question to Davis whether he wanted an attorney, and he said no?
There were clarifying questions asked in Davis, yes. As arguably there were in Jennings as well. There was an effort made to clarify. And Jennings,
but there wasn't a clarifying answer in Jennings, apparently. If there was a clarifying answer, the questions would have continued.
Well, there was no real clarifying answer. Jennings repeated what he said before. I think maybe I need to speak to a lawyer, which was basically a restatement.
If that answered the question the first time, why would there have been any follow-up from the officer?
In Officer Kreitzman's opinion, it did not answer the question. In Officer Kreitzman's opinion, he basically wasn't sure, and he decided to play it safe. Our position is that Davis didn't require him to do that, and that's what we're asking this court to hold, that Davis did not require him either to stop questioning or to ask clarifying questions.
So if there's a second inquiry, in other words, do you want a lawyer? Maybe I think I should get one. But then you ask the question again, wouldn't that be sufficient to indicate that he or she would like a lawyer? In this case, he would like a lawyer.
You have the same level of uncertainty in the second answer as you did in the first. Actually, two levels of uncertainty in this case. I think maybe. Think and maybe are both words of equivocation.
What is wrong with the rule that we adopted in Wolkowiak unanimously, essentially, that seems also, and which rule seems to be supported by the document that you provided to us yesterday, the Inbow. I didn't even know he was still around.
Inbow is not. A couple of the other two authors are.
And Inval seems to like Wachowiak.
I think Inval likes to some extent both Davis and Wachowiak. In Davis, the U.S. Supreme Court said there are going to be times when asking clarifying questions is just good practice. I think that's what Inbal is saying. I think there may be great room for discussion as to what those clarifying questions should be, what level of inquiry a law enforcement officer has to pursue. And that is where I get concerned when the question becomes an officer sometimes should ask clarifying questions versus the court compelling him to ask clarifying questions. And if the court is compelling him to ask clarifying questions, which questions should he ask? Imbal offers a one-sentence clarifying question. You want a lawyer? Yes or no? The chief's dissent in Wachowiak basically provided a very lengthy series of clarifying questions or statements that the officer would be expected to ask.
That were the same as the waiver statement upon which the majority relied, right? Didn't add anything that wasn't already in there. The majority relied on that waiver statement and said that was good enough.
If this court is inclined to require, either as a matter of practice or, and we can certainly talk about whether the state constitution requires it, but as a matter of practice, if this court is inclined to require clarifying questions, I'd urge the court to keep it simple. Look at what Imbal is suggesting, a single statement. I'm not sure if you want a lawyer. Why, yes, I agree.
It's up to you. Do you want a lawyer or not?
Yeah, I want to get it. Yeah, it's up to you. Do you want a lawyer? Thank you.
And now, did you read Wachowiak as requiring follow-up when it's an ambiguous request for a lawyer?
I'm trying to remember if Wachowiak specifically required that or
Look at 486. Because if you listen, if I heard Justice Babbage's question correctly, that's what how he read Wachowiak.
We hold that an equivocal question such as the one before us is insufficient to invoke the right to counsel. The interrogation may not begin anew until the ambiguity is resolved.
Right.
Sounds pretty good to me.
But how do you resolve the ambiguity?
Well, they resolved it in Wachowiak by saying that they asked the defendant to sign a waiver. And the waiver said that she had read and understood her right. She was willing to answer questions. And that she doesn't want a lawyer. And that no promises or threats have been made to me. And no pressure or coercion of any kind has been used against me. She signed that, and the court said that was good enough. Right?
I would say that that's probably much more than is good enough. I can envision interrogation sessions where to take the time to go through that type of a waiver, basically for a second time, assuming we have a valid Miranda waiver in the first instance, would A, interrupt the flow of the interrogation, the questioning, B, would also, frankly, run the risk of intimidating the suspect.
What's the state's position? You have an equivocal response. That's not equivocal, but let's say it is. I think I might want a lawyer. What does the state want the court to do now? Just say, okay, that's not a good enough request. You may continue interrogation. Is that the state's position?
I would ask this court to adopt the approach taken in Davis versus.
Well, that's what the Davis says, right? You may continue interrogation.
You may continue your interrogation. You may also, if it is appropriate under the circumstances, you may also ask a clarifying question.
But you're not required to.
Required to.
Is that the state's position?
That's the state's position. And after Imbal, I would add one more point to it. In preparation for the oral argument, I talked with a lot of cops on how they conduct their interrogations. I talked to our DCI agents, I talked to street cops. And I found that the use of clarifying questions is much more common than I thought it was.
Well, and obviously here the officer stopped because he knew he was on not solid footing.
I would, however, not require the degree of clarification that you would have required in Wolkowiak. I would instead lean toward the Imbau approach. Do you want a lawyer? Yes or no? And if you do, we'll stop. And if you don't, we'll continue. And if you do what Mr. Jennings did here, simply repeat yourself, the initial ambiguity in that statement, I would assume, would still carry through.
So what do you have to do? What does the officer have to do? You get another ambiguous statement. What does the officer have to do?
I would say the officer could follow Davis. Continue questioning.
So two ambiguous statements you follow. You continue questions.
The defendant has not specifically indicated that he wants counsel present during questioning. Davis controls.
And I suggested the opposite. Two ambiguous statements. You got a problem.
The majority, I don't think, answered that question.
No, because they found that the ambiguity was resolved by him signing this statement.
Are you you're talking about the majority in Wolkowiak?
Yes. Yes. But now we've got the issue.
Am I correct that Wolkowiak was decided and mandated about a month before Davis was actually issued?
I talked to Dan O'Brien from our office, who argued Wolkowiak, and that was his recollection, that there was about a month. It was awful. Wolkowiak came down. A month later, Davis comes down, and then there was the long decision from the Court of Appeals, which came down like shortly after Davis into it. So it was just bad timing.
So obviously, if we were to follow Davis, the approach taken while Wolkowiak is called into question as well.
How is the defendant supposed to know whether his statement is ambiguous or not if there is no follow-up question?
How is the suspect supposed to know?
The suspect, yes.
If the officer does, as Kreitzman did here and as Imbau suggests, say, I'm not sure whether you want a lawyer or not. What you've said to me is that you think maybe you need to talk to a lawyer. If you want a lawyer, please tell me. Or do you want a lawyer, yes or no? I would think that an officer responding to that statement would be communicating pretty clearly that it wasn't clear to him that the suspect was invoking his right to counsel.
But in this case, just in Jennings, did he actually do that? Did he simply cease questioning? That's what, unless I read the facts wrong. I mean, there was the statement from Mr. Jennings, and he had given him his Miranda rights. I think the problem you run into is when here the second officer came, and he said, oh, yes, I've already been given my Miranda rights.
Right. Yeah, 15 minutes after.
Right.
And there's no showing that the second officer knew that he had made an ambiguous request for a lawyer.
Right.
So this is clean on that basis. Now, should we hold him to the knowledge of the first officer? You know, there are a whole series of cases that anything that's known in the police station is known by all the officers. I mean, it's a fiction, but you give the police the benefit of that fiction on probable cause, right?
If you were to do that, you would still have to reverse the circuit court, because what you're holding the second officer to is the superabundance of caution that the first officer exhibited.
As you know, one of your legacies in this court is the Ramos case, so I don't want to let you go without asking you a Ramos question.
Just never get away from it. You never get away from it.
As I asked in that case to you, I know people who talk like this. It could be raining cats and dogs, and they say, I think it's raining outside. And that comes to mind in response to Justice Prosser's question of how is a suspect supposed to know that they're being perceived as an equivocal sort of response. That question by Justice Prosser triggers in my mind perhaps the need, perhaps, just like this, I equivocate, triggers in my mind the need for at least one required follow-up question. How do you respond to that?
I think most officers, as a matter of interrogation practice, will try to clarify.
Okay, but I'm talking about requirement. Just as I'm asking you that question, I mean, I have this propensity myself. Sometimes things are black and white, and I would say, well, perhaps you should consider, you know, I say to my kids, perhaps you should consider coming home on time, you know. I mean,
well,
is that equivocal?
then I return to first principles. Simplify, simplify. If Jennings says to me, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer, we go to inbound. It's up to you. Mr. Jennings, do you want a lawyer or not?
Do you think that's the better practice, requiring one follow-up question?
If the concern is identifying a response that will work in the majority of situations, that will work the best in the majority of situations, then I would have to give my support to an inbound type of question.
No, counsel, not as a suggestion, but as a...
If this court is inclined to require or compel, that is what I would ask to require.
In the COVID case, maybe this was, I went out to get the book here, maybe this was asked, but that was the question. Do you, addressing it to the investigator, do you think I need an attorney, where we're talking about the type of thing that, well, I think
maybe I need to talk to
him. Yeah, so there's a little different situation. One is asking the officer what he or she thinks they should do, and the other is this. But
Imbaugh would work in the Wolkowiak situation. Mr. Weber, do you think I need an attorney? It's up to you. It's up to you.
But if you say, and now are you ready to give us a statement after you ask to go through Miranda, and the person says, I think I need a lawyer. I mean, you look at the totality of the situation. So I don't think any one statement, you can just say yes or no because it made clear. Because after you're asking a person for something and he says, I think I'd like a lawyer. Well, to me, the verbiage, he would like a lawyer.
And I agree with you in the context of a situation where we're talking about the first go-through on Miranda, and it may well be that an officer under those circumstances would say, okay, it's fine. We won't talk to you until you've had an opportunity to get a lawyer.
Well, isn't, though, in interposing any requirement of clarifying questions at all, whether it's a little or a lot, doesn't that just run directly contrary to Davis, which says you don't have to do that?
Yes, it does.
The Constitution doesn't require you to do that, and in fact, the officer can ignore an equivocal statement and keep questioning and not have violated the Constitution.
Yes, yes, it does. Davis has held that the federal Constitution does not require the asking of clarifying questions. Davis specifically rejected as a matter of federal constitutional law the notion that Miranda or Edwards requires a third level of prophylaxis. Davis stands for the proposition that you have your original Miranda warnings and waiver, and the second layer of prophylaxis is your right to have counsel present during questioning. That's it.
And there's no difference between the state constitution and the federal constitution on this issue.
One word. The state constitution says may. I think the federal constitution says shall. Same. I'm in the red. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Margaret A. Moroney, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Mr. Jennings. Before you proceed, I want to recognize another guest we have with us today, Senator Urbanbach. Do you represent the Boscobel School District? Okay, well,
This might have been your senator, but he's not. He's all of our senators, right, Senator?
He's mine.
Thank you for coming. Ms. Maroney.
May it please the court. I represent Edward Jennings, and I'm going to pick up with a point Justice Wilcox made just moments ago, and that is when you decide whether some statement is equivocal or not, are you limited purely to the words spoken? And this court in Wolkowiak clearly said no. This court said that in determining whether a question is equivocal, the reviewing court must look not only at the words used, but also at the circumstances leading up to the request and the context of the actual request. Now, in this case, Mr. Jennings was questioned by Detective Kreitzman at 2:45 in the morning. He was handcuffed with at least one hand handcuffed to a wall. And he is blind. He gave an oral statement to Detective Kreitzman, and then Detective Kreitzman asked him to give a written statement. Now, if you think of it, a blind man being asked to give a written statement, at that point he says, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. He, at that point, realizes he needs the assistance of a lawyer. He can't give a written statement. He repeats that. And according to Detective Kreitzman, he also says things of that nature. So we know he's twice said, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. Plus he said things of that nature. And Detective Kreitzman ceased questioning him and left. Based on those circumstances and in that context, the trial judge who heard the testimony of Detective Kreitzman testified that that was not an ambiguous request for counsel. That is a finding that the appellate court should uphold. The state would like to have this court view the question whether something is ambiguous as a question of law. But as Justice Bradley pointed out in Ramos, this court recognizes that there is a lot that is not told by the printed word.
Well, counsel, there are any number of cases that are cited in Wolkowiak, especially in my dissent, that indicate that courts have differed as to what the same statement is, whether it's ambiguous, unambiguous, or not even a cry for a lawyer, right? What do they say about whether it's a question of law for an appellate court or fact for the trial court?
Well,
this only relates to the question of ambiguity, right?
Without expressly stating it, the United States Court in Davis said that it was a finding of fact, and that was at the very end of the decision.
I have a reference to Davis in one of my footnotes in Wolkowiak, and it said, it should be noted that the U.S. Supreme Court has evidently concluded that the response, maybe I should have an attorney, constitutes an ambiguous request, and I have a cite to see question presented by Davis. So I think the question is they presented it.
I'm sorry, that they presented it?
Well, the question, you know, they certified a question to the lawyers, and apparently that may have been in the question, but what did they say in the last paragraph?
In the last paragraph of the court's decision, it says, the courts below found that the petitioner's remarks to the NIS agents, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, was not a request for counsel, and we see no reason to disturb that conclusion. Now, if it were a conclusion of law, there would be some analysis of what principles were involved. But it was a factual inquiry in Davis. If you look at the facts in Davis...
What did the Court of Appeals say in Davis?
The Court of Appeals affirmed, well, actually, I'm not sure. I'm going to have to take a look.
Because, I mean, they would have the same question of whether it's fact or law.
In Davis, it was a military court, and I don't believe there was an intermediate appellate court.
Okay.
So in Davis, what the court, I want to just go over briefly the facts in Davis. In Davis, Mr. Davis said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. And immediately, as Justice Prosser noted, the officer asked him whether he was asking for a lawyer. And Davis said, no, I am not asking for a lawyer. And then the interrogation continued. And again, Mr. Davis said, maybe I should talk to a lawyer. And at that point, the questioning stopped. What Mr. Davis was attempting to argue is that that very first statement, maybe I should talk to a lawyer, you know, just cut it off right then and don't even look at the fact that immediately he answered the police officer's question with the clarification, no, I'm not asking for a lawyer. So Mr. Davis was trying to basically divide that interaction into two pieces and saying immediately, as soon as that statement was made, the officer should have cut off all questioning. And the court refused to take that type of technical looking only at the words spoken approach and instead looked at the totality of the circumstances. Now, traditionally, when a court has to look at the circumstances and assess what impact they have, that is considered a finding of fact.
Ms. Moroney, let me interrupt you for a minute. Haven't we rather consistently over the last several years taken a two-step approach to this type of question? We look, first of all, at the historical facts found by the trial court. The historical facts here, it would seem to me, would be what was said by your client. I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. But when the historical facts are looked at in the light of the constitutional principle, we've said that's a de novo determination, that's not something where we give deference to the trial court. Now, I think one of the more recent times that we've said that is McMorris, State versus McMorris. Why in heaven's name should we throw that approach out the door in this case and say, oh no, it's all one thing, and what we should do here is just take the approach of giving deference to the trial court? Because it seems to me the trial court was here saying, first of all, we've got a statement. This is what the statement was. I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. And then it seems to me the trial judge was saying, applying the constitutional principles, I'm going to suppress the statement because I think there was a violation here of the Fifth Amendment. Why aren't you arguing that he was correct on both, but we only have to give deference to the first determination? It seems to me that's consistent with our case law for several years now.
And the first point being that he said that he requested counsel.
The first point being, I think maybe I need to talk to a lawyer. That's the determination that Justice made. That's the historical fact he found. The next determination, it seems to me, is a constitutional determination, an application of the constitutional principle to the facts found. And our case law would seem to indicate there's no deference given to that. You seem to be arguing we should give deference to it.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree that the question of whether something is ambiguous is a constitutional question. The state is, of course, arguing that it is, but it is an intermediate finding. The court first reiterates the words spoken by Mr. Jennings, and then assessing the circumstances and the context that those words were spoken makes a finding that it was not ambiguous.
Okay, we'll take
and
a vol-
legal conclusion. Excuse me, Your Honor.
Well, take the voluntary confession, right? Is it voluntary? First thing they do is say all the circumstances. He's blind, he's handcuffed, it's the middle of the night. Those are all facts and questions. And unless they're clearly erroneous, we'll bow by them. But then the trial judge says involuntary. I think that the cases will say similar nature. That's a legal question we do de novo. And what Justice Crooks is asking, why I understood this question, is why isn't this the same? The trial judge finds all these facts, what was said, all of the circumstances under which it was said, then concludes this is ambiguous, that it should be stopped, or that this was an unambiguous request for counsel under these circumstances, the question should be stopped. So why aren't we at the ultimate just reviewing as a question of law under these circumstances, which we accept, we find law, or yes, whatever.
Well, Your Honor,
I think is the question.
The Constitution provides the right to counsel. And the constitutional guarantee is couched in terms of the right to counsel. The question is whether or not he invoked the right to counsel. And that is a legal question, but this is basically one of those situations where it is more in the realm of the finding of fact. You have to decide which court is best able to make this decision. Is the appellate court reading the briefs better positioned to decide that this was unequivocal, or is the trial court? And that leads you to the conclusion that that is a finding of fact. Now, I actually started out backwards with the oral argument, taking lead from the court. But I do want to mention one point. I've been troubled by this case all along, getting a grasp on it, because to me it is an advisory decision. The issue about certification, as noted by various members of the court, is one of interest to the judges and appellate attorneys, and it probably is one that would benefit from debate and being decided in some type of setting, but not in the context of Mr. Jennings' appeal. I think the Court of Appeals made a mistake in certifying this case, and the court was misled, unintentionally, I'm sure, but the Court of Appeals in a certification says that, or asks whether it must not follow a decision of the Wisconsin Supreme Court which is directly on point. And really, this case is not directly on point with cases that have been before this court. This court does not have to decide to abandon precedent and follow Davis. And so I think that this court, it basically has the option of deciding to dismiss the petition or dismiss the certification as improvidently granted. That is a possibility. And as far as Mr. Jennings is concerned, as CCAP indicates, he's been released on bail. So if this appeal proceeds for another chapter, it is something he does not object to. Another problem that I have with this case is that I really feel like the state and the Court of Appeals is reaching out. They would like this decision made. Is Volkoviak still good law in light of Davis? But one requirement is that there be an inculpatory statement. And if you really look at the facts of this case, the statement is basically meaningless. He testifies that he got out of the car. What has the state gained in terms of any incriminating information that he was party to the crime, the first-degree intentional murder? The Court of Appeals was under the impression that whatever he said in that statement led to the charges against him, and that was not true. On page 2 of the certification, it says Jennings proceeded to give an inculpatory statement which led to charges being filed against him as party to the crime. Nothing is said in the complaint as the reason why he's a party to the crime, murder.
But Ms. Maroney,
yes.
Maybe all well and good, but obviously, maybe you weren't Mr. Jennings' counsel at trial.
Right.
But it was Mr. Jennings' counsel who made the motion to suppress, so obviously he felt he'd rather not have that statement.
Well, certainly defense has, concerns that the state doesn't. And should Mr. Jennings take the stand, the statement could be used to impeach him. That's for sure what could happen. But in terms of the statement being used against him, I guess the practical reality is that there's nothing in culpatory.
Then you don't care whether it's suppressed or not?
Pardon me?
Then you don't care whether it's suppressed or not?
Well, I do care, but I don't think that this is the case for the court to be making a big change in its law. The court recently said bad fake facts makes worse law, one of the justices did, and another one said something about let's not reach out to change the law based on the facts of this case. And I just think that this is not a good case for this court to be deciding a major significant issue like this. The Court of Appeals could have a first crack at it and decide. It could look at it and decide, I'm not really sure what the trial court meant, and remand it for more findings.
Don't you think we considered that when we considered the petition for review?
Well, Your Honor, sometimes, well, is it a certification? And
I mean when we considered this certification.
True, but the court does on occasion decide that its decision to grant certification should be vacated. And last term in Marbury versus Mock, the court decided that additional briefs would be helpful and mentioned that when it vacated its decision to certify. So this court might, after reading the briefs and hearing oral argument, decide that some issue is worth briefing. I just throw out the question of whether or not ambiguity is a question of fact versus. But that certainly seems to trouble the court, and apparently the briefs haven't satisfied the court. So the first, I guess, line of relief that I ask is for the court to affirm the trial court. But the second line is to decide to vacate its decision to certify and send this decision back to the Court of Appeals for further briefing, further consideration.
What's the issue you'd send it back on?
Well, the issue raised today in oral argument about whether ambiguity is a finding of fact or a finding or a conclusion of law.
But this is a good issue. I mean, this is in the facts presented. Are we going to stick with Walkowiak, or are we going to abandon Walkowiak and go with Davis? And I mean, it seems to me that the facts here just cry out for that resolution.
Well,
and so we probably decide it anyway.
Quite candidly, what I'm troubled by is the trial court makes some inconsistent findings.
What are they?
He says Detective Kreitzman failed to receive clarification. And then he also says that Mr. Jennings made an unambiguous request for counsel. So is that...
You think he did not... You thought there was an ambiguous request for counsel?
Did I? No, I think he clearly... He did make a clear request for counsel. But the trial judge, in making his findings, did make the comment that Detective Kreitzman didn't receive clarification.
Now, there are two...
So maybe that suggests that there's some ambiguity.
There are two officers involved here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why should the second officer be bound by what the dialogue with the first officer?
Well, this court has held that one officer is presumed to have the same knowledge as another officer. And that is a good rule because it avoids trickery.
The trial court found as a matter of fact that the second officer didn't know that.
Yes, he did. I just want to point out that there was conflicting testimony on that point. Detective Kreitzman testified he did tell the second officer, and then the second officer testified that he did not. And just, I guess, to point out another ambiguity is that the trial judge also ruled that he found the police officer's testimony to be credible.
Both officers?
Here we have officers giving inconsistent statements.
Why shouldn't the court interpret the questions, or the first questions or comments that Officer Anderson made, as clarifying? I mean, didn't he say something to the effect, Mr. Jennings, do you recall your Miranda warnings? Remember those? Yeah. And then he proceeded to ask...
I wasn't clear, Your Honor. What I was referring to is the trial court said that Detective Kreitzman, the first officer, didn't obtain clarification. And so the trial court was referring to that point when Mr. Jennings said, I think maybe I should talk to a lawyer, and he repeated it. And that was the point that the trial court says failed to provide clarification for Detective Kreitzman. I think there are problems with the facts in this case, and I'd be the, on behalf of Mr. Jennings, if in fact he had said something inculpatory in that second statement, I think the case and the tenor and everything would be completely different. And I think this goes to the point that the need for, our principle of justiciability, you truly need two adverse parties with really having a stake in the outcome. And I think that's absent.
This was a contradictory statement, right? His second statement was contradictory, and that's why the trial counsel moved to suppress. He didn't want to have this statement, what's the word I'm looking for? Contradict.
Well, Your Honor, the facts are that there were so many witnesses that saw Mr. Jennings get out of the car that it really was not a huge concession for him to say that he got out of the car. And as a practical matter, defense counsels, as you're well aware, often make every motion available.
The rules require a Miranda Goodchild hearing before any statement of the defendant comes in the state's case in chief, right?
Right.
Okay, so let's stop talking about whether there should have been or should not have been a suppression motion because the statement was or was not inculpatory. Let's talk about what we do know and what is uncontroverted in this record and can't be quarreled with, and that is that all he said was, I think maybe I need a lawyer, or I think maybe I'd like to talk to a lawyer. And whether or not that falls within Davis or doesn't fall within Davis, because that's what this case will decide.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree, because there is a state constitutional issue, and of course Davis doesn't address that. And then there is the issue about the superintendent.
Are you conceding that it does fall within Davis for purposes of the federal constitution? And if we construe our state constitution consistently with the federal constitution, then the suppression motion was wrongfully granted?
No, I don't. I believe that the finding that it was not equivocal is a finding that should be upheld, because under the test in Wolkowiak that you consider the circumstances and the context in which a statement was made to determine whether or not it was equivocal, that's...
So you're saying it falls outside of Davis?
Well, Your Honor, Davis, what happened in Davis, and this is very important, is that the trial court, after hearing the testimony, concluded that the statement was ambiguous. And the appellate court upheld that finding and saw no reason to disturb it. That is, I guess, to just put that same procedural, looking at this case, we have a trial court who heard all the evidence and concluded that it wasn't ambiguous. And so what I'm asking the court is to conclude, like Davis did, that there's no reason to disturb that trial court finding.
Isn't this like the curtilage cases where the decision on whether it is or isn't inside the curtilage is outcome determinative, so it clearly falls within the umbrella of a legal question that's reviewed on a de novo standard of review? And we can't draw any conclusions from that very bare-bones statement of Justice O'Connor in that case. We see no reason to disturb the findings of the court below.
Well, I guess perhaps, as I mentioned earlier, this is an issue that deserves further briefing, because it obviously is an issue of concern.
Perhaps it doesn't deserve further briefing because it's been concluded in many, many other cases.
Well, as you are aware, there's just opposing viewpoints on this.
Counsel, let's assume that we don't accept your urgings and we decide whether Wolkowiak should be the law of this state or Davis should be the law of this state. Your brief urges that Wolkowiak should be the law of the state. Why don't you address that?
Well, I have to first of all say thank you to the state for bringing the most recent edition of criminal interrogation and confessions to the court's attention. I think this court has a number of times demonstrated its interest in providing guidance to police officers and establishing good procedure. And the court has at times decided that the Wisconsin Constitution does not require a certain procedure, but decided in the use of its superintending power that it would require that procedure. An example is in the interest of any, when the court concluded that the Constitution doesn't require a personal waiver of the jury trial right by the juvenile, but this court decided it would be good practice. I haven't heard anyone in this court say that it wouldn't be good practice to stick with the procedure in Wolkowiak. And I think that such a rule strikes the right balance between the state's interest in investigating and the interest in protecting an inarticulate defendant that inartfully requests counsel. So I would say that there are only good reasons for adhering to the Wolkowiak decision, and I don't see any reason for this court to depart, and I don't think any reason has been presented. So thank you. Unless there's further questions, I have no other comment.
Now, did you check the preceding inbound?
Pardon me?
Did you check the preceding inbound text? Because I made reference to it in my dissent. And I obviously did not find a recommendation in that the questions be asked. And Inbow's book is after Davis,
right.
And that's what he recommends.
Well,
that book does.
I guess at least
the prior edition was not very friendly to defendants.
Right. That prior edition, I guess, has been missing from the law library, and I have not.
It is not in my office.
Was that a confession?
That was a confession.
Made on advice of counsel.
Inculpatory.
Inculpatory, that's right.
You think you want an attorney?
I think I might need one.
One other question.
Yes, Your Honor.
After the exchange with Detective Kreitzer, Officer Kreitzman, was Jennings entitled to change his mind and answer questions?
Well, under Walkowiak, the rule is that the defendant must either be given an opportunity to get in touch with the lawyer or else the officers must take steps. So under Walkowiak, it wouldn't have been proper for the detective to continue interrogating.
What if the defendant reinitiates the interview? Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah. But even after the defendant talks, says he doesn't want a lawyer, what if he then says unequivocally, I'm stopping, I want a lawyer, doesn't even have to say I'm stopping, questioning ceases.
Yes.
So he can change his mind.
Certainly.
He has to do it in different ways depending on what the circumstances are.
Right, and the focus is on really what the police have to do.
This was, Davis is an interesting case. It's four justices found that when you have an ambiguous statement, you don't have to, police do not have to ask further questions, and they can go ahead. Scalia concurred on his own tack on saying you should look at 18 U.S.C. 3501. I don't know if he ultimately, I don't know that he ultimately joined them, so that was only four. So Scalia is a fifth. And joining in the judgment, and then you got four other justices who concur in the judgment too, but on a totally different tack, and they concur in the judgment only because, as Justice Prosser pointed out, it was clarified, and he said, I'll talk. And so the other four justices said, okay. They clarified it. He said, he'll talk. It's A-OK. And was very critical of the majority opinion, which only relied on the first question and ignored the subsequent events. And sounds very much like a lot of things that are said in the other four, Walkowiak or said in... both the majority and in my opinion. They too quote the first edition it's really the third edition of Inbow, in which that edition relied on, put on the psychological efforts and recommended those as good questioning techniques. So this is a significant change. So you don't have, I don't think, you don't have a majority opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court again yet. What do you have to say about that?
Well, Your Honor, I did not see that point, and I guess just quickly looking at Scalia's decision, I noticed that Section 3501, certainly in light of the Dickerson decision where the U.S. Supreme Court reaffirmed Miranda and been said, the Congress could not, I can't think of the word, except to say that they couldn't bypass Miranda by passing Section 3501. That certainly calls into question the reasoning of Justice Scalia. I think that the Dickerson case is favorable.
We can ask the state whether they agree that there isn't a 5 vote for adopting.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Maroney. What do you say, Mr. Weber?
First of all, do you want the book?
Pardon me?
Oh, you've got the book.
No, this is...
is it from the State Law Library or the Attorney General's Library?
Attorney General's Library. I don't think the state has it.
We probably couldn't afford it.
You want to know how we got it. I'll give it to the Marshal.
Thank you, and we appreciate that. Well, what about Davis? Is that an opinion we have to follow?
Every commentator that has written on the impact of Davis that I have read, and I've read a lot, has simply treated Davis as a majority for the proposition that clarifying questions...
Well, it's unanimous. I mean, there was a unanimous opinion on the judgment, on the mandate.
Unanimous opinion on the judgment, and I think that the interpretation has been that in the manner that Scalia wrote, even though he focused on 3501, they're attributing to him the conclusion that he believes that clarifying questions are not necessary. Certainly there's nothing in his
opinion that says that.
There's also nothing in his dissent in Dickinson that says that either.
Might this be an improvidently granted certification if indeed Davis isn't...
Lord, I hope
authority.
No.
I'm just asking the question.
No, it's not an improvidently granted certification. This court needs to provide guidance to the lower courts, to the intermediate appellate court, as to what to do in situations where you have conflict.
Okay, but but the underlying issue that begs it, is there a conflict?
I think there's certainly a conflict between Wentella and Davis, and if you look at the circuit court records, you'll see Wentella moved large in the circuit court's decision making here. And Wentella was a fact situation that was pretty close to this one, where you had language like think and maybe in the invocation, the alleged invocation of the right to counsel. Justice Babbage has characterized this as conflict between Wolkowiak and Davis, and I think it is, but more fundamentally, when it gets down and dirty and the circuit court is saying, yeah, this was an invocation, they're saying it in part because in Wentella, this was a good invocation of the right to counsel.
What did Wolkowiak say about Wentella?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know what this court said about Wentella in Harris a few years ago. This court said that Wentella gave precious little guidance after all the passage of case law. I think this court specifically said it doesn't give us much guidance in light of Edwards and Davis, and there might have been one more case in there, and it may have been Wolkowiak. I don't remember.
Is there a difference between an equivocal reference to an attorney versus an ambiguous request for an attorney?
And I spent a lot of time thinking about that, too. The language in Davis talks about equivocal versus unequivocal. And I think I may have mixed in briefing those words and ambiguous, and I wish that I had not.
Well, because, do you think they're different, ambiguous versus equivocal?
Ambiguity is a term of art that most commonly surfaces in cases of statutory construction, and I'm not sure we'd want to engraft the statutory construction case law onto determination.
We should use equivocal.
I would.
Okay. Now, is there a difference between an equivocal request for an attorney and an equivocal reference to an attorney? Because Wolkowiak says it was an equivocal reference to attorney.
I think the net legal effect under Davis would probably still be the same. That would not be good enough.
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. But I could see a suspect might say, well, you know, attorneys are really expensive, but I know there are a lot of them that have offices around the courthouse. That might be an equivocal reference to an attorney versus, I think maybe I need a lawyer.
Is it possible to uncouple the questioning by Detective Kreitzman from the questioning by Detective Anderson? Is Anderson bound by what goes before?
The circuit court made a finding of fact that it was a continuous period of interrogation, and I think that he did that primarily for the Miranda implications, because Anderson didn't give Jennings a full recitation of Miranda. He didn't get a new Miranda waiver. He simply made reference to it. So to the extent that the court found as a matter of fact that it was a single course of interrogation, this court may be bound by that unless it's clearly erroneous. And you raised the point, and I did not think of it, whether Anderson's questions could have been considered clarifying questions for purposes of the Davis analysis, and I would have to think about that. I wish I could give you a quick answer on that, but I would want to think about it. If it's dispositive, we'll file a supplemental brief to be sure.
And it may fit under Wolkowiak, where he signed a Miranda statement.
It may, but we still, this court, I think, still has to come to grips with the impact of Davis. It's not a problem. Please don't send this back to the Court of Appeals.
Okay. But you really want a decision that you don't have to follow Wolkowiak.
I really want a decision that says that Davis has first of all, overruled Lentella, and that Davis controls on questions of whether there was an invocation, at least from the federal constitutional point of view.
I think you should be arguing Wolkowiak overruled Lentella. Maybe. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Weber. That concludes our hearing on...